Hey everyone, Jeremy here. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm really excited about today's episode because we'll be talking about how responsible AI is done at Facebook. Now, Facebook routinely deploys recommender systems and predictive models that affect the lives of literally billions of people every day. And with that kind of reach comes huge responsibility, among other things, the responsibility to develop AI tools that are ethical and fair, as well as well-characterized. This really isn't an easy task. Human beings have spent thousands of years arguing about what fairness and ethics even mean, and we haven't come to anything close to a consensus on these issues. And that is exactly why the responsible AI community has to involve as many disparate perspectives as possible when they're determining what policies to explore and recommend, and that's a practice that Facebook's responsible AI team has applied itself. Now, for this episode of the podcast, I'm joined by Joaquin Quinonero-Candela, the distinguished tech lead for responsible AI at Facebook. Joaquin's been at the forefront of AI ethics and the AI fairness movement for years, and he's overseen the formation of Facebook's entire responsible AI team basically from scratch. So he's one of relatively few people with hands-on experience making critical AI ethics decisions at scale and seeing their effects play out. Now, our conversation is going to cover a whole lot of ground, from philosophical questions about the definition of fairness itself to practical challenges that arise when implementing certain AI ethics frameworks. This is a great one. I'm so excited to be able to share this episode with you, and I hope you enjoy it as well. Joaquin, well, thanks so much for joining me for the podcast.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure, and I absolutely love your podcast.
Well, thanks so much. It's a thrill to have you here. I'm really excited for this conversation. There's so much that we can discuss, but I think there's a situational piece that'll be useful to tee things up. And that's a short kind of conversation about your background, how you got into this space, how somebody just came in from outside of ML, an academic journey, and then eventually came to the position that you're in, which is leading up the Responsible AI Initiative at Facebook. How did you get there?
We have to have a deal where you can interrupt me whenever you want, because once I get talking and talking about my journey, you know, I can go on. I think at a very, very high level, I finished my PhD in machine learning in 2004. At the time, very few people used the word AI in the community that I was in. You know, the NeurIPS community was mostly an ML community. I had a little stint at being an academic. I was a postdoc at the Max Planck Institute in Germany. And then I had my first transition was I joined Microsoft Research in Cambridge in the UK in January 2007 as a research scientist. And so what happened there was a very fundamental thing in my career, which is that I came across product teams that were using machine learning. In particular, we started to talk to the team that would become the Bing organization, so Microsoft Search Engine, before it launched. And we started to apply ML to increase the relevance of ads for people. And specifically, we were building models that would predict whether someone would click on an ad if they were to see that ad. That work really got me hooked to the idea that ML was not just something that you did in scientific papers, but it was something that you could actually put in production. So in 2009, the Bing organization asked me, hey, why don't you leave the comfort of Microsoft Research, you know, that comfortable sort of research environment, and why don't you become an engineering manager and sort of lead a team within Bing? So I did just that. It was probably one of the most stressful and dramatic transitions in my life, because I knew nothing about being an engineering leader. You know, I wasn't used to doing, you know, road mapping, headcount planning, budgeting, being on call, you know, being responsible for a key production component. So it was pretty stressful. But at the same time, it was wonderful because it gave me the view of the other side. And one theme that has been recurring in my whole career and still is now is this idea of technology transfer, right? Like the funnel that goes from a whiteboard and some math, some ideas, some research, some experiment, all the way to a production system that needs to be maintained and running. And so this transition gave me a first-person view into that other world on the other side of research, that other world where sometimes, you know, as a researcher, you'd go and you'd say, hey, you all should consider using this cool model I just built. And, you know, people would go like, I don't have time for this. You know, I'm busy, right? So now all of a sudden I was sort of on the other side. It was a great experience. Ended up also helping to build the auction optimization team as well. So that got me to learn a little bit about mechanism design and economics and auctions. And then I came to Facebook in May 2012, I joined the ads organization. I started to build out the machine learning team for ads. And then I think the second big moment in my career happened, which is that I think the phrase I would tell everyone is, it just hit me really hard that wizards don't scale. So the challenge we had is, we had a few brilliant machine learning researchers at Facebook, but the number of problems we needed to solve just kept increasing, mm-hmm. right? And we were almost gated by our own ability to move fast. People would be building models in their own box, you know, having their own sort of process for shipping them to production. And I felt the whole thing was slow. And the obsession became, how can we accelerate research to production? How can we build the factory? And that was an interesting time because all of a sudden, the difficult decision there was to say, well, rather than rushing to build the most complicated neural network for ranking and recommendations possible, let's just stick to the technology we have, which is reasonable. We were using boosted decision trees and we were using sort of online linear models and things like that, which are, you know, relatively simple. At large scale, that's maybe not that simple. But the idea was like, can we ship every week? Can we go from, you know, wow. taking many weeks from, yeah, that was a vision. The vision was ship every week. It became almost like the mantra, like everyone was like ship every week. And so that led us to build the entire ecosystem for managing the path from research to production. And it did many things. It's a set of tools that we built across the company. It's sort of it's interesting because it was focused on ads only. The idea was that it would be very easy for anyone in ads building any kind of model to predict any kind of event on any kind of surface to actually share code, share ideas, share experimental results, almost also to actually to know who to talk to. Actually, a big thing is to build a community, right? The vision was for this to be agnostic to the framework you actually express your models in. You know, when TensorFlow and Keras became popular, we supported that, of course. We support PyTorch, but if you really want to write stuff from scratch in C++, be our guest. It's pretty agnostic, right? It's all about sort of managing workflows. And yeah, you know, what ended up happening is that teams started to ask to adopt what we were building. And fast forward in time, what happened is that the entire company adopted what we built. We started to add specialized services on top for computer vision, for NLP, for speech, for recommendations, machine translation, basically everything. And that led to the creation of a team called Applied ML, which I helped build and led for a few years, which essentially just provided for the entire company and sort of democratized ML and put it in the hands of all product teams. The idea was that, you know, since wizards don't scale, you don't need that many wizards. The wizards will be the creators of, you know, fundamental innovation, but then you can have an ecosystem of hundreds, if not thousands of engineers across the company who can very easily leverage and build on those things. So I did that until 3 years ago, essentially. And I'll take a breath here in case you want to ask me any question about this part before we transition into, I guess, what would become then the third big moment, which is a transition to responsible AI.
One of the big take-homes for me in this, especially with the second phase of your career, is you're talking about implementing processes, like getting really, really good at implementing processes. And it seems to me, anytime people talk about AI ethics, AI fairness, that sort of thing, that this is the thing that gives me chills or makes me a little bit nervous about the whole space is the apparent lack of consistency. It's hard to know like what AI fairness is, what AI ethics is. It seems like everyone has a different definition. And it's also unclear to me how, even once we have those definitions, we can then codify them into processes that are replicable and scalable. So that expertise must have been critical, right? I mean, that process development flow, that's going to map onto the fairness in AI work.
It does. Now you hit the nail on the head. It's interesting because a lot of the things we did when we were democratizing AI inside the company are being very helpful now that we're working on responsible AI. Although maybe that was not the first idea we had in mind, but the idea that right now we have the tooling that allows us to see what are all of the, you know, models that are deployed in production across Facebook and who's built them and what went into them turns out to be to give you sort of this level of abstraction and consistency, which is really important. But of course, there's a lot more to responsible AI. Like you said, there is broad disagreement on definitions of concepts. So maybe let me tell you about my own journey into that world. I had been following with a corner of my eye the Fairness, Accountability, and Transparency workshop. I believe the first year it took place was probably 2014 or something like that at NeurIPS. And then it kept sort of recurring. And then I believe 2018 might be the year where it spun out in fact, I attended that workshop. It became its own sort of separate conference, and it took place. 2018 was in New York. But just before that, end of 2017, at the NeurIPS conference, there were a couple of fundamental keynotes by people like Kate Crawford or Solon Barocas and many others. I'm sorry, I'm going to be forgetting names. It's not that I don't care. It's just a Friday in a long week, And it just became obvious to me, like my whole brain, you know, exploded in a way. And I thought the time is now. It's obvious. The time is now. We need to put the foot on the gas here. We need to go all in. We need to go from, you know, initial efforts to really, really build a big dedicated effort that focuses on responsible AI. And then as a, you know, with my background as someone who loves math and as someone who loves engineering and as someone who loves processes and platforms and giving tools, right? Giving people tools. Mm. Sort of, okay, well, I think we can figure algorithmic bias out in a couple of months.
We laughed. It can't be that hard.
Yeah, it can't be that hard. How hard can it be? I thought, you know, let's take a look here. So I looked at some of the work, some of the definitions. And then of course, you know, immediately it became clear, this is work by Arvind Narayanan, who gives this beautiful talk, like 21 definitions of fairness and their politics. There's a talk he gave at that 2018, at the time it was called the Fat Star Conference. Now it's called the FACT. In the community, we're great at coming up with terrible names like NIPS and FAT. And then we sort of, luckily, we renamed them.
Move fast and break things.
Move fast and break things. So I thought, okay, well, that's fine. Out of these 21 definitions, you know, there seems to be some of the definitions of fairness try to equalize outcomes between groups. Some of the definitions of fairness try to focus on treating everyone the same. And I'm like, okay, how many do we really need? It's like, maybe implement a couple. You know, I imagine like a drop down box, you know, we're like, okay, which one do I pick, you know, as an ML or a practitioner. I thought, you know, we can have beautiful visualizations of like data composition broken down by subgroup, you know, accuracy of your model, calibration curves, like all these things. I'm like, okay, we got this, you know, we can get this done in a couple of months. Then it hit me like a ton of bricks that AI fairness is not primarily an AI problem, and that math does not have the answer. And that it's extremely context dependent, what definition of fairness you should use, that you need to build multidisciplinary teams that involve people who come from moral and political philosophy. That's actually extremely important. And probably the most important one of all is that fairness is not a property of a model. It's not a status box. It's actually a process. Fairness is a process. In fact, I'm going to tilt the camera a little bit and show you. I'm wearing this t-shirt we made for the team that says fairness is a process.
Ah, very nice.
So this is a this is a set of t-shirts we built for the team because I kept repeating this all the time. And so our executive assistant for the team one day came up with this pile of t-shirts for everybody. Says, okay, you all keep saying all the time fairness is a process. Well, here you go. So anyway, we wear them with pride. You're never done. The thing that maybe is a little bit hard for an engineer to think about it is that this is not like, oh, I'm going to build, you know, this microphone here and it's done, right? I've tested it. It works. It's not like that. And if you go back in time, I guess humanity has been discussing fairness since Aristotle and we're still discussing and we don't agree. And it becomes political as it should, because you have different ideologies. So You need to build these processes that are multidisciplinary, that involve risk assessments, surfacing the decisions, documenting how you make them, and all of that. And that's only for fairness. Obviously, in responsible AI, you have many other dimensions to tackle as well.
I love the idea of fairness as a process, partly because there's this well-known principle called Goodhart's Law. As soon as you define a metric, you say, we're going to optimize this one number, then all of a sudden people find ways around it. They find hacks, they find cheats. Arguably seeing that with the stock market today, you know, the time was back in 1950, as a general rule, if the stock market went up, people's quality of life went up. But now we're seeing a decoupling as people start to play games in politics and optimize around it. This seems like, is this part of the strategy, is like recognizing the fact that there's no single loss function, no single optimization function to improve, and instead let's focus on the process?
Absolutely. I have several things like I'd like to say about this. First of all, every single metric is imperfect. Even if you're not working on fairness specifically, the moment you set a metric goal, and in particular, I think one of the reasons that many technology companies are very successful is that I think we can iterate fast, we can be very quantitative, we can be metrics driven, and we can move those metrics. But that at the same time is also potentially our Achilles heel, right? That is what can actually get you into trouble. So it's essential to develop very strong critical thinking, and it's essential to develop what we call counter metrics, right? Like other metrics that work sort of in opposition, which you should not make worse as you make this one metric better. But
can
even
you
that an is
an example of one of those, actually? That sounds like a fascinating idea.
A simple idea would be, imagine that you are trying to improve the accuracy of a speech recognition system, and you're measuring it by a word error rate or something like that, whatever you want. So one countermetric you could build if you cared about fairness is you could actually break down, you could disaggregate your metric, say in the US you could do this by some geographical grouping, since accents vary across the country. And then your countermetric could be that you cannot decrease performance for any group, right? Because averages will always get at you, right? Like you can actually, you can make things twice, better for the majority group, you can make them worse for another group, and you might not even realize, right? So that'd be a sort of like a very fairness-centric metric. But you could imagine many other scenarios where you're trying to optimize many aspects of an experience, and there are certain things that you don't want to sort of make worse.
You talked about, I think one of the first comments you made about this was fairness, or definitions of fairness, are not a challenge for like the data scientists. That's not something they should have to worry about, which makes total sense. Data scientists don't have time to get philosophy degrees and degrees in public policy. But then I guess it's going to be someone's job ultimately. And whether that's a policymaker or somebody with like more of a liberal arts background, one question that comes to mind is like the character of conversations around these metrics gets really deeply technical really fast.
Yeah.
And I imagine like just being able to communicate the nature of the decisions being made, like that's its own challenge. Do you see that coming up a lot? And are there any strategies that you use to address that challenge?
It's a challenge. One of the things we've been having success with is to define a consistent vocabulary for talking about fairness across the company. And also a consistent set of questions that are increasing in their complexity. To make this very concrete and illustrated with examples, one of the most fundamental definitions of fairness you can have is to ask the question, does my product work well for all groups? The question of defining groups is very context dependent as well, of course. To my left, I have our Facebook portal camera, and it has a smart AI that is capable of tracking people. If I'm video conferencing with my parents in Spain, or my parents-in-law in Germany, which is basically now you can imagine how our weekends go with our kids, or we're sort of video conferencing with them. We've actually given them some of those devices too, because it's really annoying if you have your phone that you're using to, you know, to Skype or to FaceTime or to use whatever software you use. It's really annoying to sort of, you know, try to keep, you know, the frame centered and so on. And so with Portal, it's magic. But the AI that tracks people and that sees if you have two people, you know, to zoom it out, crop and center and everything, you can't take for granted that it's going to work equally well across skin tones, mm-hmm. or genders or ages, right? In that context, you can say, well, how do I define a minimum quality of service? And a minimum quality of service is going to be that the failure rate where someone gets cropped out or something has to be smaller than a certain small percent of the time or of number of frames or sessions or something, right? And that's a reasonable concept, this idea of minimum quality of service. I want my product to work well enough for everybody. Of course, within the context of my product, one of the key questions is, hey, given what you're trying to build, who are the most sensitive groups you should consider? Later on, if you want, I'll put something in the topic jar, which is we can talk about election interference, and we can talk about how AI can help in that context. And we can talk about the India elections, and we can sort of then reason about what groups are relevant in that context. But back to a second, to the Portal example, the most basic set of questions about fairness would be, hey, can you disaggregate your metrics? You know, teams have typically launch criteria, right? So the data science, the ML team will say, hey, is this model good enough? Well, the question is, instead of having an all-up metric, disaggregate it by group. In this case, it could be skin tone. There's many scales you can use for this, age and gender. And then for each of those buckets, look at the bucket for whom the performance is worst. And imagine that was the only population you had. Would you still launch, right? If the answer is no, then maybe you need to sort of sit back and sort of figure out, okay, how do I make sure that I'm not leaving anybody behind? Then leading to the India elections, there is one set of questions and one definition of fairness that is more comparative in nature. In a way, minimum quality of service compares against the bar, but it doesn't necessarily, you know, then worry about, oh, it may work still a bit better for a group than another. It's fine as long as it works, you know, well enough for everybody. And I'll put another topic in the topic jar, which is you know, Goodhart's law and how even, you know, you can sort of game or screw up your minimum mm-hmm. quality of service as well. But the next level up would be equality or equality of treatment, right? You could sort of say, okay, well, I actually care about differences in performance. And the India elections example goes like this. Last year around April, May, if I remember correctly, we had the biggest elections in the history of humankind. Mm. I think it was close to a billion registered voters or something along those lines, a little bit less than that, but massive. And, you know, in a time where there are many concerns of misinformation and attempts of manipulation, the way we would tackle this without AI would be to have humans who are given standards, community guidelines, content policies, and who check that content doesn't violate those. And then if it does, you sort of take them down. But the problem is at the scale of this election and at the volume we have, there's no number of humans you can hire to do this, right? So then what you need to do is you need to prioritize the work. Because obviously, you know, my posts about me playing the guitar or, you know, featuring my cat or my dog don't, you know, we shouldn't waste time reviewing those. But if there are issues that politicians are discussing, or even if it's not politicians, organizations are talking about, you know, civic content that discusses social or political issues, then we should prioritize those. So we built an AI that does just that, that we call it the civic classifier. So what it does is it sifts through content and it identifies content that is likely to be to be civic in nature, and then prioritize that for review by humans. What's the fairness problem? Well, the fairness problem is that in India, You have, I think it's over 20 official languages, and there are many regions that have very different cultural characteristics. Mm-hmm. So already, if you break down your population into regions and languages, you can see how those actually correlate with things like religion or caste, right? And yeah. And like the social issues that concern people in different regions are different. But now you have an AI that's prioritizing where we put those human resources to review content. What happens if that AI only works well for a couple of languages and it doesn't work for others? So if you take the language analogy, what happens if it overestimates risk for a language, meaning we would prioritize, we put more human resources to review posts in that language. And if it underpredicts or underestimates the likelihood that something is civic in nature for another language, then we're not allocating enough human resources there. And there we decided not to stop at minimum quality of service. We thought this is a case where we really want equal treatment. And since what we have here is a binary classifier that outputs a number between 0 and 1 that sort of says what's the probability that this piece of content is civic, then what we said is, well, we want those predictions to be well calibrated for every single language and every single region. So again, you know, the notion of fairness there, we sort of set a higher bar because this was like about fairness of allocation of resources. And then just to complete the picture, the third common definition and sets of questions associated that we're also using internally is around equity, and is around asking not just should we treat everybody or and everything the same, or should the performance of a system be above a certain bar for everybody. The question then becomes, is there any group of people, for example, for whom the outcomes, or the product outcomes, deserve special attention? And this can be because there might be some historical context that we should take into account. And one example we've seen in 2020 in the wake of racial justice awareness in the US has been the focus, for example, at Facebook on business outcomes for Black owned businesses. So we've built product efforts that help give visibility to Black owned businesses, because we felt that the Facebook platform has the opportunity to help improve a situation that was already there. This was many times the question, right, when you think about fairness too, is one of responsibility, right? Mm. It's like, okay, people may say, well, but society is biased, and here I am, I've built a neutral piece of technology. I don't have skin in this game. And I think what we're saying is it doesn't work that way, right? Your piece of technology can't reflect these biases, it can't perpetuate them, it can encapsulate them inside a black box that legitimizes them or that makes them very difficult to debug or understand. And then on the flip side, you know, technology can also make outcomes better for everybody. But, you know, sometimes we have to ask ourselves, is there any group that we're going to prioritize? That was a lot of words.
I think it's hard to answer the question, how is fairness managed at Facebook in a tweet or less? But I think it's really interesting, the different kind of lenses and different approaches to fairness you're describing. From a process standpoint, one of the things I'd be really curious about is like, where within the organization does the decision with respect to which standard of fairness to apply come from? And do you think that the process for making that decision is currently like formalized and kind of structured well enough? Obviously there's going to be iteration, but do you feel like you have a good sense for how that process should be structured?
Yeah, so we're building the process, but what was very clear to us is that it's a hub and spokes model. Mm. So we have a centralized responsible AI team that is multidisciplinary. It has, as I mentioned earlier, not only AI scientists and engineers, but it also has moral and political philosophers and social scientists. And what that team does is the whole layer cake between, you know, that ranges from providing an ethical framework for asking some of these questions to then going more into the So that would be like the qualitative part, if you will. Then going more into the quantitative part, which is like, hey, how do we, now you talked about equality versus minimum quality of service. And for equality, you talked about binary classifiers. What does that actually mean in math? Like, what do I look at? Do I look at false positive rates between groups or something like that? Answer, no, we don't necessarily, because that has problems. But, you know, what do you do, right? And then there's another layer beneath this, which is more the platform and tooling integration. So how do we, again, leveraging all of the work we had done in Applied ML, how do we make it really easy and really sort of friendly to be able to break down the predictions of your algorithm, you know, by groups, et cetera. So you have this entire layer cake, including things like office hours, which are actually really important, is centralized. And then what you see is that every product team is building their own embedded expert group that will collaborate very closely with the centralized team. And the reason you have to do it this way is that you need the centralized team to have consistent practices, consistent terminology and definitions. But the decisions, to your point earlier, need to be made in context. And so it would be impractical and inefficient to have the centralized team make hundreds of decisions that are very context dependent. And then the biggest thing is, because we said it's a process, you don't make the decision once and you're done, right? You keep at it, right?
Yeah.
I think it's, just as a side note, I watched the movie Coded Bias by Shalini Kantaya. It features Joy Boulamwini and Timnit Gebru and Cathy O'Neill and many other brilliant researchers on responsible AI. And I think it must be really dangerous to try to cite people live and then get the person wrong. One of them, I'm going to keep it at that level of abstraction because I don't remember who said it. One of them said something like, many of these responsible AI practices, like fairness, they're like hygiene. It's like you have to brush your teeth every day. That's how I think about it. And you have to do it in context of your product, right? So we're seeing an increasing number of product teams build their own embedded effort, and we collaborate very, very closely with them.
And how do you decide, like, so there's an almost economic aspect to this that I'm fascinated by. I think I saw Amanda Askell, one of OpenAI's AI policy specialists. She tweeted about this idea that there's a motif right now in the AI ethics community that, like, if I can find a reason that an algorithm is bad, then that algorithm simply should not be deployed. Like, there's kind of that vibe in the zeitgeist to some extent, where people will say, oh, well, like, this algorithm, like, discriminates in this marginal way. And of course, we know all algorithms will inevitably discriminate in some way. So there's got to be some kind of threshold of some sort where we say, okay, this is too much and this is not enough. How do you think about the economic trade-off from that standpoint? I mean, you could try to, you know, de-bias algorithms until the cows come home, but at some point something's got to get launched. So yeah, I guess, how do you think about that trade-off?
I think it's extremely difficult to come up with a purely quantitative answer to that question, right? I mean, as a math and engineering person, I'd love to build a cost function where I say, if I'm reducing hate speech using AI, the cost of a false positive is $40 and 3 cents. and so that's very hard. I think what that touches on, I think, is on a few things. It touches, I think, on transparency, and it touches on governance. Mm. And where I believe things are going to go is that the expectation is going to be that when you build AI into a product, that you are very transparent about the risk benefit analysis. Mm-hmm. There's a phrase that I'm using these days, and I'm probably stealing it from someone, and I don't know. This idea of AI minimization, this idea of in the same way as people talk about data minimization, so AI minimization. You know, should my instinct, instead of my instinct being let's use AI because it's cool, right? It should be like, can I do it without AI?
Yeah.
and then if the answer is like, maybe, but then if I put AI, it adds a ton more value for everybody. It's like, okay, well, that's justified, right? I have a value. And then comes the flip side, which is all the list of risks, right? And one of the risks may be discrimination, or it may be other definitions of unfairness. Mm-hmm. And I think being transparent about those trade-offs and having ideally like a closed loop mechanism to get feedback and to adjust and see what's acceptable. I think this is an inevitable future that we will be in. An example that I use a lot is not an AI example, but again, I'll say it again, many of these problems are not primarily AI problems. Think about content moderation and the difficult trade-off between giving everybody a voice and allowing for freedom of speech, but on the other hand, protecting the community from harmful content. And there is misinformation that is obviously harmful. We've come to the firm conclusion that we neither can nor should do this ourselves or on our own. And when I say we, I'm of course speaking, you know, as a Facebook employee, but I think this is generally true across technology. We're experimenting with this external oversight board. Maybe you've heard of it. It's a group of experts. It's taken a lot of work to the team that put them together, to sort of come up with the bylaws and how they're going to operate. But let's focus on the spirit of it for a second, right? Like the spirit of it is that there will be decisions that are tricky. No content policy is ever going to be perfect. I mean, and so it's essential to have humans in the loop and to have a governance that includes external scrutiny and expertise. I think at the end of the day, it's going to be this interplay of transparency, of accountability, of governance mechanisms that are participatory, right?
Yeah.
If you zoom out and you think about AI in 10 years, right, being very prevalent, being very consequential, one big question is going to be one of participatory governance, right? Like how do you or I have a say in where the AI that drives, our relatives or our pets to the vet, right? I mean, that would be pretty phenomenal, right? Like some sort of self-driving.
Yeah. And that itself, it's almost as if it imposes this sort of like energy tax on the whole process where, you know, Facebook, I think it's great that Facebook is doing this. I think it's great that Facebook has a responsible AI division. And to some degree, it makes perfect sense that it can only happen at scale today, because it's only at scale that, you know, companies like Facebook and Google and OpenAI can actually afford to build giant language models and giant computer vision models. But over time, as we're seeing the cost of compute drop exponentially, as we're seeing the ability to use pre-trained models increase exponentially, it's like, you know, the smaller players are going to have more and more ability. There's more and more sort of destructive footprint that every little tiny startup will have. Do we get to a point where there's got to be some sort of governance solution that can apply to these small players? I mean, maybe this is it's probably an unfairly hard question to ask because it's so hard to imagine how that would work. But do you have any thoughts on how the future might develop in that direction?
Oh, it's a super easy question. We have 14 minutes to go. We're going to solve it. It's an absolutely excellent question, and it's extremely exciting. One thing that has changed a lot in my life as a scientist and as an engineer is that I've gone from almost never talking to policy, to the policy team. And I say this with a lot of love to the policy team, but way back when, whether it was at Microsoft or in my early years at Facebook, you'd go talk to policy maybe like once, you know, before you started to work on something to seek approval, of course. And then once it was ready to sort of see that, but it'd be a bit like, I hope it's going to be okay. I hope I didn't mess up, you know, and it's like a check. Now I talk to policy every single day and not just once, right? Like tons of time. And we have brilliant people on the AI policy team, many of whom have actually come from civil society organizations. Mm. And I never thought that I would one day say that I enjoy policy work, but I have to say that I sort of do. And you know, we've been talking to a lot of organizations. We've been talking to the OECD. We've been talking to the Brookings Institution. We've been talking to expert members of the EU Commission that's been working on, upcoming regulation. There's this white paper that came up earlier this year from the European Commission expert group. And the idea there is like, how do we regulate AI? And I think that's such a fundamental question. It's crazy. I hope that Don Wright, the idea is that it will cover both the cases at scale where a company like Facebook or any of the other tech giants can be held accountable. And maybe to your point, it's easier because there's like one address, you know, and one person you can hold accountable. Once you get into tens of thousands of startups, right, that are using the technology, there I think we're going to see things like, well, who's the technology provider, right? Like, are they using any ML solutions on the cloud? Yeah. Where do you draw the accountability? Is it, you know, oh, here's some embeddings, you know, use them at your own risk. You know, like who's accountable for that? Is it going to be, I think there's going to be accountability at all levels. Accountability is at the level of all the way from like the creator of the technology, the person that packages it, makes it available, the people who integrate it in a product, the people who commercialize that product. And my intuition is that hopefully we can leverage precedents that may exist in other sectors. And one of the things that I think is really fascinating too is, do you focus the regulation on the technology itself? Do you try to regulate NLP, natural language processing, or do you do it more by sectors? Is it more like AI in medicine, AI in education? My intuition is it's probably going to be both. I think the sectorial part is easier to visualize for me. And there's also a lot of existing regulation that we should leverage. But again, that's just my personal opinion.
Well, and it's these questions get so complicated so fast. And this leads, I wish we had more time for this, but I do have to ask a question about partnership on AI, because I think it's such an important part of this equation. One of my personal concerns is actually, we've talked a little bit about this here, but just the idea that there really is like safety, privacy, fairness, ethics, all this stuff, they do take the form of what is effectively a tax on organizations that are competitive. I mean, Google has to compete with Facebook. Facebook has to compete with everybody else. It's a market, and that's a good thing. But as long as there's a tax for fairness, as long as there's a tax for safety, that means there's an incentive to have some kind of a race to the bottom where everyone's trying to invest minimally in these directions to some degree. And at least the way I've always seen it, groups like Partnership on AI have an interesting role to play in terms of mediating that interaction, setting minimal standards. I guess, first off, would you agree with that interpretation? And second, how do you see Partnership on AI's kind of bigger role as the technology evolves? I know this is a big thing, but I want to make sure I get your broad thoughts on partnership.
No, and I'm glad, I'm glad that you brought up Partnership on AI. I am on the board and have been very involved for the last couple of years. And I think it is an organization that the world needs. But I would love your help with understanding the logic behind the race to the bottom hypothesis. And maybe we can make it very concrete by picking any dimension of responsibility that you want. I'm just struggling a little bit. I want to make sure that I really understand what you mean.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm imagining, actually, I'll take an example from the sort of alignment AI safety community. So one common one is a hypothesis. I don't necessarily buy into this, but I'll just, for concreteness, let's assume it's true, that language models can be scaled arbitrarily well and lead to something like, super powerful models that are effectively oracles or something like that. So that they're essentially unbounded amount of stuff you can do with super large language models. And to the extent that safety is a concern, like, you know, you might not want an arbitrarily powerful language model that can plot and scheme. Like, you can say, hey, how do I swindle like $80,000 from like Joaquin? And like the language model goes, oh, here's how you do it. And yet, like, companies like OpenAI are competing with companies like, you know, DeepMind or whoever else to scale these as fast as they can. Whoever achieves a certain level of ability first, that, I mean, there's a decisive advantage in even like a 6 months of lead time or whatever. There are analogs for this across, you know, you got fairness and bias and so on. But there's always some kind of value that's lost anytime you engage in this sort of company to company competition, where you could invest the marginal dollar in safety, or you could invest the marginal dollar in capabilities. And that trade-off is something that I'm wondering if partnership on AI could play some sort of role in mediating between organizations, setting standards that everybody at least thinks about adhering to, that sort of thing.
Yeah, thank you. I understand the question. The question makes me think a little bit about environmental sustainability in a way, right? Where you could have the same race to the bottom in many ways, not only between companies, but even between countries, right? It's like we have one planet, you know, who's going to commit to cutting CO2 costs? Like, oh, well, just a second, I'll be back in a moment. Like,
just after this tree.
exactly. I think the partnership on AI plays a key role on many fronts. First, being a forum, a very unique forum that brings together every single type of organization you can think of, right? Academia, civil rights organizations, civil society, other kinds of non-for-profits, small companies and big companies. And some of these organizations on a partnership on AI are going to be actively lobbying and shaping and informing upcoming regulation. So I think there is already a bit of pressure there somehow for big companies to be involved and to lead the way, because the failing to do so may mean that you have to deal with regulation that is bad for everybody. So I feel like that's one angle. The other angle is efficiency. So some of that work that you described, some of that dollar that I could, you know, that I could either invest in making sure that my big language models are human value aligned and that they're not, you know, evil. Well, if you have an organization that is supported by a large number of for-profit companies, and they do the work, projects like About ML is a project that I love, that builds on documentation practices for data sets and for models, right? So it's a combination of ideas like data sheets for data sets and model cards and things like that. These are extremely powerful. And we at Facebook are definitely paying a huge amount of attention and experimenting with that. And I'm glad that we can use something, you know, a relatively off the shelf, but very well thought through, that we didn't have to build ourselves, and for extra points, that gets the validation and credibility that you get from, you know, it being built by an organization like Partnership on AI, that doesn't represent just our interests, right? And I think that's going to be a common pattern, right? That thing of the 360 view that you get by having a multi-stakeholder organization that has everybody. Second, just the efficiency and convenience of having best practices and recommendations that come from people who really know what they're doing, and where you know that everybody was looking, while this was being created. And then the third one is really like the legitimacy and validation that you get by using something that, hey, these are not like the ethical principles of Facebook, right? I mean, if people frown and people were like, oh, well, I mean, what interests are represented there, right? Only Facebook's versus it coming from the Partnership on AI.
Yeah, it's actually, I mean, it's one of those organizations where I'm hoping to see a lot more of them in the future. And it seems like the kind of thing that the nascent kind of kernel of that organization is hopefully going to keep blossoming, because we need, as you say, some kind of multi-partisan oversight of the space at so many different levels, and it's great to see the initiative taking shape. Joaquin, thanks so much for your time. Actually, do you have a place where you like to share stuff, like Twitter in particular, or a personal website that you'd like to point people to if they want to find out more about your work?
Oh, you know, I have a confession. So I'm a late Twitter adopter.
Oh, that's probably good for your mental health.
But I now feel a strong sense of responsibility to be contributing and engaging in the public debate, hard as it might be. Mm-hmm. So I would I'm gonna embarrass myself so much right now by having to even look up my Twitter. On Twitter, I am at J Quinonero. So it's letter J and then my first last name. It's complicated. I have two last names because I'm from Spain.
We can share it.
And we have exactly. Yeah. No, I'm gonna be. I have made a personal commitment to engage more, and I'm gonna have to learn how to do this in a way that doesn't disturb my mental health, like you were saying.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest challenges, especially for some reason, especially I find with Twitter, is keeping that mindful state and not getting lost in the feed. Boy, anyway, we're in for a hell of a decade, but I really appreciate your time on this. Thanks so much and really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. It's an absolute pleasure to be here, and thank you for doing this podcast, and thank you for getting everybody involved in these kinds of conversations.
My pleasure.